and welcome to another episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. I'm your host and Vice President of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Dave Perry. On today's show, which we're recording June 10th, 2020, we're going to be speaking with Major General retired Doug Dempster, William Richardson, and Eleanor Sloan, who, along with myself and several others, wrote Toward Agile Procurement for National Defense, Matching the Pace of Technological Change, which is a policy paper available on our website that we published in conjunction with the Canadian Defense and Security Network. The report is reflecting on some workshops undertaken in the fall of 2019 in conjunction with a number of Government of Canada officials. The workshop is one of the first activities for the procurement team of the Canadian Defense and Security Network, and CGAI is happy to partner with them on it. William Richardson is a policy analyst at Global Affairs Canada and recently completed his master's studies at the Norman Patterson School of International Affairs at Carleton University. Major General retired, Doug Dempster served as a defense strategic planner and later as NATO Assistant Secretary General for Executive Management, and most recently as the head of the Center for Executive Leadership at the University of Ottawa. Eleanor Sloan is a professor of international relations in the Department of Political Science at Carleton University in Ottawa, in addition to being a fellow with the Canadian Global Affairs Institute. Doug, Eleanor, William, welcome to Defense Deconstructed.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for having us.
So the report that we're going to talk about today was the result of a series of activities that the four of us, as well as about a half dozen other participants, engaged in over the last year and a bit. And most immediately, that was the kind of takeaway from a workshop we did last fall, just to set the scene, with a number of officials from the Department of National Defense, a number of people from across the different agencies in the Canadian government that are involved in procurement, including central agencies officials, as well as a number of academics and graduate students. So the point of it was to touch on what DND specifically is seeing as one of its key challenges right now, which is dealing with the pace of high technology and rapid change, and trying to cope with that. They're trying to introduce greater degree of agility into their procurements. So Doug, I'm going to ask you to start off the conversation, but just giving at a high level your sense of what the kind of the crux of the issue is that national defense is facing, and how that is different or similar to past discussions that we've had in Canada about defense procurement.
I think there are three issues of context for the agility discussion on procurement. The first is that military operations themselves are increasingly agile. They have to handle hybrid warfare, terrorist outbreaks, regional instabilities that are not predictable. We've always scrambled to get the technology we need at the crunch point, but this capability agility now needs to be built in to support operational flexibility. The second point, I think, that's obvious to everyone is that the procurement and technology cycles have completely diverged. Procurement cycles are measured in decades, and technology cycles are now in months, in some cases weeks. This was difficult before, but it's almost unworkable now for any kind of digital system. And thirdly, we have the nature of the powerful collaborative tools, both social and applications, that the COVID period has brought to prominence. We can go faster together without the rigidity of so many formal gates by simply working together. That's my take.
And so a core piece of that, and you're touching on the diverging timelines between technology and procurement, relates to the nature of basically what kind of systems, what kind of technology the military is using. And that's evolved over time. So, Eleanor, can you talk about that a little bit, the shift increasingly to dual-use technology, the fact that the military in Canada and around the world aren't just using purpose-built equipment for the military anymore. Increasingly, it's leveraging civilian technology, which works on a different time cycle.
Yes, absolutely. When you look at the Cold War, you see that most of the defense advancements were undertaken by government. They were funded by government defense research labs. And defense drove all these changes, the internet, barcodes, GPS, everything that's familiar to us. And now what we see is that defense industrial base, what we knew it to be, has completely changed. And it involves all sorts of civilian companies, and it's civilian companies now that are driving technology, and everything that the civilian companies are doing are things that defense wants, whether it's autonomous systems, artificial intelligence, robotics, 3D printing. All of these things are important also for military operations. Only really a few things that you can see there is only specifically military, and that's stealth capabilities and precision force. But for the vast majority of areas where defense needs to have capabilities for their operations, they're driven by commercial companies.
And then another key aspect of this is the fact that if Canada wanted to, we could potentially just sort of wait out the technology cycle and deal with the fact that the procurement timelines don't mesh up with what's happening in industry. But the other kind of driver behind this search for a more agile approach is the fact that we have to work with other people, and if they're buying stuff faster and at a higher rate, then we have interoperability issues. William, can you just elaborate on that a little bit and sort of talk a bit about how the interoperability concerns that Canada has specifically are driving us in this particular direction?
Yes, I'm happy to. Thank you. So, I mean, when we're talking about interoperability, we have to keep in mind that Canadian defense policy is fundamentally predicated on alliances and partnerships and working together with other countries. And at the top of that list of allies and partners is unquestionably the United States. The U.S. is Canada's most important ally and security partner. The Canadian Armed Forces serve alongside the U.S. military each day in a variety of operational domains, and it's therefore incumbent upon Canada to maintain interoperability with its southern neighbor at the technical, tactical, operational, and strategic levels. And at the technical level, interoperability, when we're discussing it, it really refers to network connectivity. Canadian military platforms and systems must be able to communicate securely with American forces. And when the United States upgrades software-enabled military equipment, so too must Canada. Canada must maintain common technical standards with the United States. It must keep up. And this interoperability imperative influences the capability requirements that drive Canadian military acquisitions. To give an example, the interoperability that exists between Canada and the U.S. in NORAD is really quite unique. This is a binational command where Canada has to maintain command and control, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and tactical fighter capabilities that are all in lockstep with the U.S. military and completely even interchangeable in some cases. So a failure on Canada's part to integrate with the U.S. at this high level impacts the ability of Canadian forces to take part in key operations and carry out the missions assigned to them by government. And the United States is really changing the way it does things vis-a-vis tech right now. As it implements advanced operational concepts like the multi-domain battle space, wherein information is a currency spread around the battle space across domains between friendly units, Canada has to field forces and systems that can participate in this sort of new way of doing things. This requires agility and procurement. We have to be able to keep up with the advances by our allies. Canada also has a larger network of partners and allies to consider when procuring high-tech military capabilities. These include the Five Eyes and NATO. Both groupings generate common technical standards and collaborate on capability upgrades. As the systems in question grow increasingly complex and expensive, Canada needs a military procurement regime that is agile enough to keep up with the evolving technical standards of allies while also delivering value to the Canadian taxpayer.
I wonder if I could just jump in here for a moment.
Please.
Okay, great. And so interoperability, yeah, absolutely important. But there's another aspect as to, you know, why we need to be able to integrate the knowledge and the capabilities of commercial companies. And that's because our challengers are doing so. So when you look at countries mm-hmm. like Russia and China, these are countries with a huge, huge appetite for emerging technologies. Also Iran in the area of cyber war. And so for Canada, we need to focus on being able to work with the United States, be interoperable with the United States, to undertake missions with the United States. But at the same time, the United States is looking at its potential peer challengers and thinking, okay, they're moving ahead of us and we need to keep up. And so that's another whole reason that we need to keep in mind our ability to really harness a commercial capabilities and work with commercial companies.
I was just going to say, I think a point to consider there is that some of those other countries, China particularly comes to mind, have a fundamentally different relationship with commercial entities. Whereas in Canada, you have these long, sometimes antagonistic processes of going through competition. In some of these other potential peer countries, you've got much greater complementarity or I guess even in close relationships in that between governments and commercial suppliers. William, I think you were stepping in there.
Yeah, I mean, I think also it's worth considering that Canada has like a long history of defense cooperation with the United States, but also specifically sort of research, like scientific research cooperation with the United States through FORA, like the National Technology Industrial Base, which has been sort of successively expanded over its existence. And we need to be looking at how we do things with our partners in these sort of settings and spaces and thinking about how we can upscale that to try to generate the level of innovation and agility required to sort of take on these challengers that are themselves sort of adopting agile procurement mindsets. I think we have, in terms of interoperability, some sort of very solid foundations to work from. We just have to sort of look at them in sort of new and imaginative ways. Yeah, that would be my piece there.
I think at the same time, on the flip side of this, away from some of the really sexy high-tech stuff, you have some more basic paces of change that drive the need for Canada to update just to comply with international regulatory standards, which is less about fancy zigzags, but it's also important to be able to actually operate in the places where we want to send the equipment that our men and women are using. William, you can talk a little bit about that and the need to try and keep pace with some of those changes on their own.
Yes, I can. Yeah, so as you introduced, something like a CF-18 fighter jet, when it flies overseas, it has to comply with a number of both international regulations and regulations that are specific to the country in which it is operating. A lot of those regulations pertain actually to navigation and air traffic control and what I sometimes call interoperability with the airspace. And then they also pertain to environmental standards. So essentially, the sort of the safe operation of the aircraft in that area and its environmental impact. And so these sound like sort of very basic requirements. And to be honest, they're not particularly onerous or high end. They're not, as you said, they're not as sort of quote sexy as emerging technologies. And yet they can be quite difficult to meet, especially under Canada's current procurement regime. It's really quite challenging because they can be. Actually, I want to stop there if that's okay. But I would like, I'll continue on that. These regulations are critical to the safe operation of military platforms. And right now, we need often, in order to meet these regulations, to run lengthy procurement processes and spend significant amounts of sort of time and resources getting platforms basically back to baseline so that they can operate overseas and do exactly what they've been designed to do. For example, right now, Canada is investing heavily in life extensions for the CF-18 fleet. And this is a major project, but it will only bring the CF-18 sort of back to baseline. It will allow it to do what it already does today. So we have a system in place that is really quite rigid and unforgiving because we need to try to have these changes done quickly and efficiently so that we're able to just continue to have platforms operating. And I think that today we have these periods where there are waivers required or even Canadian forces can't operate in a certain domain or space for simple regulatory reasons.
And then from my vantage point, I think one of the final kind of chunks of this is the fact that increasingly the equipment that we're having the forces buy is a supercomputer that's connected to different pieces of metal or plastic that'll either move on the ground, float in the water, or fly in the air, or go up into space. But it's increasingly the computer that makes the biggest difference in terms of what the actual weapon system can do. And so that, Elena, brings in a number of different challenges just on its own when you're buying different supercomputers that all ultimately have to work together, in a potentially a joint capacity between our Air Force and our Navy, as an example, but also just between different projects that the Navy would acquire. And that becomes more difficult when you really have to deal with a whole bunch of issues about software compatibility. Where do you think the challenges are going in that particular respect?
Yeah, so I sort of see three issues here. With the advent of software-enabled technology, as we've sort of already discussed, the rate of technological change in the defense sector has increased dramatically. So this does create several problems. And the first is that national defense regularly conducts acquisitions for pieces of military equipment that must be completely integrated with other platforms or systems before they can generate tactical effects on the battlefield or satisfy an operational need. This integration, of course, is enabled by software. So when related equipment is purchased across multiple procurement programs, as it often is, these programs inevitably progress at different rates, and they exacerbate issues related to technical currency to the extent that compatibility and ultimately the utility of the equipment itself can be threatened. So Canada has traditionally lacked a mechanism that permits the revision of a project's requirements past its definition phase. So when we are acquiring complex equipment across projects, we need a mechanism that allows us to maintain currency across that equipment and adjust the project so that they remain in line with one another. The second issue is that capability upgrades are a central component of a piece of military equipment's in-service support phase. However, the software that allows today's military equipment to function is changing at an increasing rate. To give an example of a high-end piece of military kit, the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter actually receives weekly over-the-air software updates. To continue to keep advanced military equipment functioning simply as intended, National Defense needs to update their supporting software packages at increasingly regular intervals. And some of these upgrades may be relatively simple to carry out, but we've seen that others could trigger vastly more complex procurement projects that leave major pieces of military equipment dangerously outmoded for extended periods. And the third and final challenge that I'll bring up today is that in the current fast-paced technical environment, the specific requirements for a project may not actually be known while that project is progressing through its various stages. We can see this especially in procurements for sensors and communication systems, both areas in which rapid technical advances are being made. So what is needed for such products is a baseline requirement for a so-called minimum viable product that can be tested and modified in accordance with technical advances and evolving operational needs. The legacy procurement system in Canada simply does not allow for such an iterative and even innovative approach.
Listening to an episode of Defense Deconstructed on the CGAI Podcast Network. These engaging conversations from the front lines of policy and politics are brought to you by the Canadian Association of Defense and Security Industries.
Doug, I'm going to ask you to take up what William just introduced there in terms of the process and the way that our system currently works and expand on what he was touching on there in terms of some of the issues that have arisen in terms of process. And I guess because you've got some historical perspective on this, having worked on this in several different capacities over a few decades, how much has that process changed at a time when you've seen this acceleration in technology moving towards the increased pace of refresh, as you said, moving now in months and not in just in years?
Yeah, I think the foundation of the process challenge is that the Treasury Board policy is mandated to be completely risk-averse. And if I try to live my personal life in a completely risk-averse way, it means I either pay a huge insurance premium somehow or I build huge moats and barriers around my life. And so what we have in fact done is layered on more and more layers of risk-reducing, risk-mitigating procedures and controls to the point where we subsume the reality of life. It's unreasonable to try to offload all your risk onto a contractor when if you're working collaboratively with a contractor to get a product out, you are contributing to that process, your contribution becomes part of the risk. So in my view, we have to get over being completely risk-averse to make any progress. If there was complete risk-aversity, we wouldn't have any cell phones in our pockets today. The second point is that the combination of the even newly amended D&D Project Approval Directive, or PAD, and the PSBC supply manual with its large number of standard acquisition clauses reflects a rigid, as William said, a rigid industrial age waterfall process, a linear stepped process. Each step, each gate requiring brief ups to layers of oversight committees. And meanwhile, of course, the technology clock is ticking. And challengers, as Eleanor said, are moving forward, and project teams are idling, waiting for a decision. The third point, and William's already touched upon requirements becoming ironclad, and you can't recycle or reiterate them we have operational experiences, we get technological advances, we should be able to cycle back and look at these need statements and not leave them chiseled in stone. The reality in the Canadian procurement context is that almost every project has schedule slippage. We hold the requirements dear, we don't move on them, we don't have any more budget, so we invariably let the schedule shift to the right. Well, we're adding more procurement cycle. Meanwhile, the technology cycles keep cycling and we end up with more premature obsolescence. And I think the most difficult issue in our process is the shrinking of the contractor pool. We have, in every procurement case, large numbers of documents and huge numbers of compliance matrices. So I think after a while, the companies that work within this process start to look like government and behave like government. And we degrade their capability to bring modern, innovative technologies into the fore. So I think those are the core process problems.
And to continue on that last point, Eleanor, that's something that you've looked at in terms of the structure of the industry and what the defense and technological base is increasingly looking like. What are you seeing in terms of how it's evolving in both on its own, but also in terms of how the government relates to industry on these procurements and ways that are potentially shaping a marketplace that may or may not be innovating the way that we would want?
Well, certainly the defense industrial base is now being driven by civilian companies, and we're not seeing the government responding as quickly as necessary to that environment. And Doug just pointed to the number of regulations, risk-averse regulations in the Treasury Board. Indeed, there's a number of reasons why commercial companies really don't want to do business with government. And one of them is bureaucracy, paperwork involved, all the hoops that need to be jumped through in order to do business with government. So that's one of the big drawbacks in terms of commercial firms dealing with the government. But there's also a few others. Treatment of intellectual property, that's a key issue. This is seen as something that, you know, firms don't want to do business with government because they feel that they're going to have to abdicate their intellectual property, and indeed the regulations might read that they do have to give the intellectual property rights to government, and so they're going to want to hang on to that. And if it's bureaucratically difficult to do business anyway and the margins for profit are growing smaller, then why bother? And then finally, there's also the public relations aspect. Like some businesses will not want to do a business with government because with defense firms, for example, let's say that there's a small company in Silicon Valley that creates a component for light armored vehicles that are being produced in London, Ontario, which are being sold to Saudi Arabia. So they might end up getting bad press because of that. And so there's the public relations aspect of businesses dealing with government. All of these things need to be overcome because defense, in fact, needs to be able to work with civilian commercial entities because they're now the drivers of all the technology that defense needs, or most of the technology that defense needs to have. And so government needs to, what the Defense Department and more broadly, of course, it's a public works and Treasury Board, et cetera, process. What needs to be done is there has to be processes in place that make it easier for businesses to do business with government and not have so many hoops to jump through and be able to hang on to their intellectual property as much as possible.
To go back to the government end of this equation, another impediment, and William was touching on this a little bit earlier, is that in the government, there's a segmentation of funding between the funds that are allocated to buy something new and those that are put in place to keep something that already exists and is already owned going, and those draw from different pools of money. Doug, I'm going to get you to expand on that a little bit because one of the jobs that you did before you retired was in a position that no longer exists, but was in that kind of key money manager or at least director position within the Vice Chief of Defense Staff's organization. So how does what's colloquially referred to as the color of money impact how you can actually keep your force technologically relevant?
It's a critical issue. Dave, we keep our platforms for many decades. Ships, aircraft, and so forth. And we go to operations any time during that platform life cycle. And it may be perfectly modern and fully fit, or it may be towards the end of its life cycle and needs a boost to get going. So this issue of being able to be agile when we have long-standing platforms is kind of critical. One of our best projects ever, the Halifax class upgrade, used mostly Vote One or operations money, national procurement money, plus a set of Vote 5 capital projects kind of intermingled like raisins for new capability in one project plan that avoided multiple dockings for each ship. And it proved to be very popular both with the Navy and with contractors, and operationally we had more ships available to go to sea. In software and software-like projects, the question is, where does renovation stop and new capability start? Every line of software is potentially a new capability. So I would argue this is akin to installing a dishwasher in a 1960s kitchen reno. We're extending the function of washing dishes that was already in the sink, but we'll see this as reasonable to put in a dishwasher in our time. So in a practical sense, I think we need to do some blurring of the colors of money. I think we could, in fact, stretch the rules for Vote One national procurement funding to allow for some subsystem capability upgrades and some interoperability improvements as part of Vote One national procurement funding. And I think that would be very helpful to keep our platforms moving across their long life cycle. Yeah, that's my take on that.
Just to keep that going even further, I guess a metaphor that might work better for other people listening. If you need to, for whatever reason, upgrade your personal phone, your smartphone, even if you just want to replace it, presuming you get any version that's newer, the software is going to be better and it's going to have more functionality. So even for your own personal circumstance, if you're just replacing the exact same thing, you get a better product at the end of the day. So that introduces some of the dynamic around to what degree something is a new capability versus just a replacement. And so, Doug, since you brought up the Halifax class modernization, you mentioned some aspects of how that project was managed. Talk a little bit about what you see in some of the potential changes to process that would allow defense to deal with this issue better.
Yeah, Dave, I'm going to be radical for emphasis in my comments in this area. I think we have to turn the process upside down. We have to start first with trusted practice project practitioners who, as a team, as a collaborative team, stay with the project for significant periods of time. So I think if you start with the right people in the right organizational teamwork context across government and industry, that can solve a whole lot of problems. Every time you have a turnover of personnel, you have a gap, a continuity problem. And this is a problem in many large projects. The second is, I think you start with a clear outcome statement, and you set limits of flexibility on the project team, the larger project team, and you incorporate an iterative approach with off-ramps. So we cycle back. If necessary and we're not making significant progress, we can off-ramp. We can all off-ramp and fail early if we have to. The third, I think, and it's very important, it's been proven on other naval projects in particularly, is mandate teamwork across the government departments and the industry consortia teams with a top-level vice president or higher-level group from each organization that oversee not performance, but behavior on the project. Everyone's playing on the team. Fourth point is, I think you need to allow the team to adjust critical requirements or specifications, again within limits, as their experience grows and as the testing continues. And finally, I think we need to encourage progress in shortening timelines. We should have project cycles that emulate the technology cycles every 6 to 12 weeks, accelerating the process and getting this time-to-market notion, getting the equipment in quicker, so that we can get the capabilities in the hands of soldiers, sailors, and airmen and women earlier. This then emulates the strategy of the tech sector, and we use those same strategic advantages to help us instead of to hinder us. So I think we need to turn ourselves kind of inside out or upside down in our thinking in terms of adjusting these processes if you want to be agile.
William and Eleanor, and I'm going to start with you, Eleanor. What do you think is important to consider in this respect as we move forward? And what can the government of Canada to do to be more agile when it comes to buying major equipment and information technology-enabled systems?
I think the big picture is that the procurement process right now is very much an industrial age process where you go through a number of different steps to come out with a piece of equipment, and that can take 10 or 15 years all told. And what we really need to have is an information age procurement system. And what that might mean is that not everything is treated the same, and that there might be still the industrial age procurement system for the big platforms, but treat the software a little bit more, a little bit differently, and adjust that somehow to the procurement process, to what is a very fast moving digital environment. And this might mean moving away from just one procurement system, because right now, whether it's a regular procurement or an urgent operational requirement, everything goes through the same steps. But perhaps move away from one model of procuring things and have a different system, perhaps for digital technologies, for software. Already in the United States, you see them moving in that direction, categorizing things differently, and acquiring the digital technologies through a different system. And that might be a way that Canada can think about keeping what's good from the old system, but then adjusting the other elements to make our procurement system more agile.
William, I'm going to give you the last word in a minute, just before I note that I'm doing this in part because William was the person that ultimately helped the pen on compiling this report. And we had, I think it was 8 or 9 different contributors. So for anybody that's listening that's looking to hire a recent master's graduate, this individual did one hell of a job pulling together a report. And it was no easy feat. So William, with that set up, last word to you.
Thank you very much, Dave. That's very kind of you. So I have 2 points that I think are probably worth bringing into the mix. The first is, and it's sort of been introduced, but I believe that we need reformed partnerships between industry and government that facilitate the joint procurement of capability solutions. The defense team sort of needs to, I think, partner earlier with industry in order to gauge what capability solutions exist, but sort of before hard requirements are hammered out. And it needs to communicate its needs or challenge statements to industry. So from there, you have a sort of collaborative process that is coming along. Contracts should be iterative and award on a competitive basis, as I think as Doug suggested. We really, in Canada, should not be tied to one capability solution and one supplier so early on. And in the words of then Treasury Board President Scott Bryson in 2017, such an approach to procurement requires, quote, fewer blind marriages and more constant dating. And I think that's sort of an interesting way of putting it. And just to give an example, Britain recently selected, or a couple of years ago, selected General Dynamics as its, quote, transition partner on the Royal Navy's next generation, on the Royal Army's next generation tactical communications. And in the UK, we see a prioritization of an open, agile architecture from the outset, rather than a pre-specified technical system that General Dynamics is purely delivering. So this is a partnership model that I think we in Canada can learn from and should be moving towards adopting. And my second point is that a broader cultural change is also required in defense procurement. Trust and accountability must be rethought and embraced in order for agile methods to be adopted. There have been significant errors in the past in the procurement space, and they've led to multiple layers of oversight and procedure. Now, that has built up confidences, and it has delivered results in certain very sort of high-profile ways. But the system has become too rigid for the technical age that we live in. And the goal, I think, should ultimately be to reduce the constraints in the system rather than continue to build them and work through them. But this sort of this pursuit requires greater trust and risk tolerance, and there's certainly a trade-off, I think, between risk and results. So we have to be able to fail fast, as was said earlier, and then learn from our mistakes. The defense team ultimately needs to be given the authority and flexibility to try out different approaches in an effort to deliver the advanced capabilities that the Canadian Armed Forces require with greater speed and regularity.
Dave, could I jump in? There's one point that I meant to make and didn't. And sort of builds on what William said. I think when it comes to responding to this environment, what defense and the government in general, because it's not just defense, as we know, there's many departments involved, what needs to be done is to focus on barriers to non-traditional defense contractors. The government knows very well how to work with Lockheed Martin, with Boeing, with BAE Systems, etc. But look at what are the barriers to smaller firms and non-traditional defense contractors in dealing with government, because ultimately that's where the cutting edge technology and advances are being made.
Okay. Well, thanks for, I think, really helping illuminate what's a pretty dense report, but again, to William's credit, extremely well written, covering a lot of material. So thanks to you all for joining to discuss that. The last question before we let you go, and I'll start with Doug and then Eleanor. What are you reading these days under what is hopefully the last few weeks of the full Ontario lockdown?
Thanks, Dave. I'm working my way through slowly through Steven Pinker's book, Enlightenment Now, A Case for Reason, Science, and Humanism. It's restoring my faith in humanity.
Thanks, Dave. I always just try and get through The Economist every week from front to back.
Thanks, Dave. I'm just about to start reading The Splendid and the Vile by Eric Larson. It looks like an interesting history of Churchill around the Battle of Britain period.
Okay, that covers the waterfront. Thanks again, all three of you, for joining us today on Defense Deconstructed.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of Defense Deconstructed, part of the CGAI Podcast Network. Our guests today were Doug Dempster, William Richardson, and Eleanor Sloan. If you like the show, please remember to rate us and leave a comment on your podcast app. And if you like our stuff, please feel free to check out our donation page at cgai.ca/donate. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. The podcast is brought to you by our team in Ottawa. Thanks go to our producer, Jay Rankin, and Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Dave Perry, and thanks for listening to this episode of Defense Deconstructed.